Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Well, Monday is the date which the Constitutional Council, which serve very similarly to what we understand to be a constitutional court, will announce the judicial award that they have issued in respect of the general elections that took place on the 9th of October.
Opponents of the Mozambican government are calling for another round of protests on Monday.
One of the challenges that we have on the continent is that gender-based violence is a reality that we've been dealing with for centuries. And if it is not resolved and not dealt with, it is going to inhibit significantly the growth and development of the continent as a global player.
A new African youth survey shows near unanimous support for women's rights.
So for us, engagement with the government to ensure that policies and media laws are conducive to journalists to practice their critical information role, watchdog role, and agenda setting role.
And the Executive Secretary of the Media Council of Tanzania welcomes calls for more collaboration between the government and the media. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Mozambique, opponents of the administration are calling for another round of protests on Monday. This as the Constitutional Council plans to issue a ruling on the outcome of the October 9th general election. The National Electoral Commission had declared Daniel Chapo, the presidential candidate of the ruling Frelimo Party, the winner with 71% of the total votes. The main challenger, independent candidate Venancio Mondlane, came in second place with 20%. But opposition groups rejected the outcome of the elections, alleging voter irregularities and rigging. The European Union Poll Observer Mission also raised concerns about voting irregularities. The International Monetary Fund has warned that the weeks of post-election unrest will affect economic growth. For analysis of the latest political development, I reach Rodrigo Rocha. He is a lawyer and political commentator in Mozambique.
Well, Monday is the date which the Constitutional Council, which serve very similarly to what we understand to be a constitutional court, will announce the judicial award that they have issued in respect of the general elections that took place on the 9th of October. According to our law, that is the most fastest date that the Constitutional Court can somehow bring the verdict on the elections. And there is a reason, a legal reason for that. It's because when the Constitutional Court announces this verdict, the new elected bodies, and I'm referring to not only the president, but also the members of the parliament, they have to take possession within 20 days.
You know, there have been calls for dialogue to ease tensions in the country. Why hasn't this succeeded here?
To be honest, there has been an initiative from the current president to hold these conversations. He invited all the candidates for the elections, the presidential elections, and one of the candidates refused to come, allegedly that he is not in the country and that there are some lawsuits against him, which they exist, but there is no warrant, arrest warrant against him, so he could easily come. But I understand, and this is my feeling, that there are some ongoing conversations with the parties. This is not an official information, because I am no one to give this official information, but this is my reading based on the fact that the the candidate to the presidency that is creating and heading part of these riots and protests, he has released recently live on social media, saying that the protests should be suspended until further notice.
But concerns raised by opposition groups, including the main opposition figure, that the elections were rigged or there were voter irregularities during the polls, have not been addressed.
Mr. Venancio Mondlane, the so-called opposition on the presidential election, has not submitted to any legal court in Mozambique any formal protests against the presidential elections. So he's claiming, based on assumptions and not even following the law, to submit any sort of protest or appeal to any judicial court in respect to the elections. He is complaining out of the legal system instead of trying to understand and fight this in the legal system. So I have doubts that there is any, fraud in the elections that is substantial to cancel the elections.
Rodrigo Rocha is a lawyer and political commentator in Mozambique. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. A new African youth survey shows near unanimous support for women's rights. The findings also show the youth want politicians to address rising violence against women in Africa. Conducted by the Ichikowitz Family Foundation, the market research shows that 75% of young people reported that they are very or somewhat concerned about levels of gender-based violence in their countries. It comes as experts say there's consensus among young adults that there are not enough female African leaders. For more about the findings, I reach Ivor Ichikowitz. He is the chairman of the Ichikowitz Family Foundation.
One of the challenges that we have on the continent is that gender-based violence is a reality that we've been dealing with for centuries. And if it is not resolved and not dealt with, it is going to inhibit significantly the growth and development of the continent as a global player. And over the years, we've seen that not only is the youth becoming more aware of gender-based violence as an issue, but they're also starting to identify it as a problem, whereas my view is when we started asking questions about this, gender-based violence was identified with, but it was never considered to be a major issue. Today, it's considered to be a major issue, and there is a call on government, and there's definitely a call on social leadership to deal with this. And I think that we're in a generation of youth today that see this as a major issue that has to be resolved for once and for all. And I see that as very positive.
Why do you think government appear not to have been so forceful to either address or the perpetrators punished when it comes to violence against women on the continent, because the youth appear not to be pleased with that?
I think that we must acknowledge that we're at an inflection point in the history of the continent. A lot of governments in Africa have been juggling the realities of tribal culture, traditionalists, and the reality of the continent moving into the developed real world, or I suppose let's call it the global world. I think we must not suggest that the cultural and the traditional world of Africa is not a real world. It's a very real world. But there are some clashes between that real world and I suppose the real world that the youth of today find themselves in. The African youth of today are connected to the rest of the world. They're connected to Western value systems, they're connected to Eastern value systems, and they're connected to their own tribal value systems. So we're starting to find a new combined kind of conglomerate of value systems that are driving the youth that we're talking to. And whereas gender-based violence may have been acceptable as a traditional norm historically, the next generation are saying this is not cool. We need to deal with it. We understand where this might have been acceptable in traditional culture, but it's not acceptable into the future. And I think for that reason, governments are starting to be pulled into that reality too.
There are suggestions that Africans want to see more women in decision-making process, which they think will form a part, as part of the effort to reduce or try to combat gender-based violence. Your thoughts?
I think that this is absolutely correct. I think that before, a lot of the respondents acknowledged that they lived in a very patriarchal society. My personal view, in all the years I've done business and lived and worked in Africa, is if you want something done in Africa and you want it done efficiently, get an African woman to do it. And I think slowly but surely, the value of African women, the value of their intellect, the value of their ability to contribute to the growth and the development of society is starting to be identified. You're also starting to find that African youth see men and women being entitled to the same levels of education, seeing men and women being entitled to the same jobs. And as we progress past the colonial and apartheid days, we're starting to understand that the African women and the power that reside within this demographic can play a massive role in the development of the continent.
Ivo Ichikowitz is the chairman of the Ichikowitz Family Foundation. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll take a look at how tech startups are using artificial intelligence.
You could use it both ways, in two different ways. One is to use it as it is, or you could train it.
Creating content has become so easy.
But it's also up to us as AI practitioners, the smaller companies that are leveraging AI, to think about how we can use it responsibly.
Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
In Tanzania, the Executive Secretary of the Media Council of Tanzania is welcoming as a positive development calls for more collaboration between the government and the media. Ernest Sungura also says public officials should take a cue from President Samia Suluhu Hassan, who was recently quoted as saying the media is an essential stakeholder in national development and not a competitor to her administration. His comments came after Palamagamba Kabudi, the new Minister of Information, Culture, Arts and Sports, said the government is committed to increase collaboration with stakeholders to promote press freedom. Sungura adds that the move will boost the ability of the media to help the country's development. For more on the expected working relationship between the government and the media, I reached Ernest Sungura.
Yeah, collaboration is a very good move because this has been our approach at the Media Council of Tanzania, and it is also within the coalition that we are leading, Coalition on Right to Information, which has more than 16 members. So for us, engagement with the government to ensure that policies and media laws are conducive to journalists to practice their critical information role, watchdog role, and agenda setting role, which basically is enabling an environment towards a democratic Tanzania, and at the end of it, all development. So if you hear a statement from the minister buying in the idea of collaboration, that's a very good move. So we are really welcoming such a move.
President Samia Suluhu Hassan recently said that the media is not a competitor to the government, but an essential stakeholder in national development. But some media people in Tanzania say some public officials treat the media as if it's an enemy, attacking journalists, some media houses being shut down and all that. How do you respond to this?
As long as you hear this kind of voice from the top, I think the other, you can call them subordinates, they need to understand and not only the statement that the president issued during the Media Stakeholders Development Conference in June this year, but also in line with the four R's about reconciliations, reforms, and all the R's that she has been emphasizing. The media should also be in line with that, and also the other leaders who are supporting the president must also align to such a tone by the president. So having some of the other leaders arresting or influencing against maybe media freedom, That's not something right for them to do. And I think in all, we need to really understand, and we need to continue educating them.
What do you think the government can do, apart from this overtures, to increase media freedom and free speech as guaranteed or protected by the Tanzanian constitution?
The first step, I think, is to ensure that some of the concern that we have as media stakeholders, the government need to listen and that need to be to change. We raised concerns on 21 sections of the Media Services Act that they need to be changed, and at least 9 of them they were amended, but we're still trying to influence so that 12 more are also amended. The other thing that the government needs to do, if you can call the Media Council of Tanzania with the other partners, they put a case at the East Africa Court of Justice, and actually the court ruling was in favor of the Media Council of Tanzania with other colleagues. And it has a statement that government needed to do amendment in the Media Service Act. And that's also an important thing for the government to do. Once they comply with the ruling of the East Africa Court of Justice, will it guarantee conducive working environment? And I think for me, that would be a very great deal. The government should not fear. That should be the starting point.
What are your expectations of the newly appointed information minister?
We have a big hope and expectations that the sections and some of the laws that we are concerned with, they will be amended, because we already discussed with him about fast-tracking the information and broadcasting policy review of 2003, which has been there for more than 20 years, and it needs to be reviewed. And this is the entry point for even amending some of the sections that they are not in favor of the journalists.
Ede Sungura is the Executive Secretary of the Media Council of Tanzania. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Africa's mining sector is witnessing a surge in legal disputes in the Sahel and Central Africa as mining companies face increasing scrutiny in the countries in which they operate. The disputes stem from tax and customs audits and a lack of expertise in managing finance, arbitration and change in legislations in some countries. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
In a statement Wednesday, officials with the Barrick Gold Corporation said its operating entities in Mali submitted a request for arbitration to the International Centre for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, ICSID, to address the disagreement with the Mali government regarding the Loulo-Gounkoto complex. Barrick, the world's second largest gold miner, and the Mali military government have been in a dispute over new mining rules since 2023. The new rules seek to give the state and local private investors a 35% interest in mining projects, up from 20%. The International Arbitration, or ICSID, registered cases in 6 sub-Saharan countries this year: Angola, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, Senegal, South Sudan, and Tanzania. Of the cases filed by investors and countries, 28% were in the oil, gas and mining sectors, the highest. Beverly Ocheng is a senior analyst with Control Risks, a firm specializing in political, security and integrity risks. She says inward-looking countries and mineral rights are causing authorities to clash with mining firms.
Across the continent, there has been this bigger drive towards resource nationalism, whereby countries feel that because they are the biggest stakeholders of those resources, whether it's gold, whether it's zinc, it's uranium, that they ought to put in legislation or update their legislation to make sure that the governments are earning a lot more. So it hasn't quite led to disputes in other countries in the way it's publicly played out with Mali, but it is bound to raise some concerns about how those transitions happen.
Mining experts argue that political instability, particularly in countries like Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, changes in mining laws and alliances have affected companies that have been mining in those countries for decades. Some countries have shut down mining sites because of alleged environmental damage and failure to remit taxes to the government. Disputes between companies and states arise from changes in government, insecurity, political instability, tax evasion, tribal authority, and environmental and social issues. Paul Ogendi teaches law at the University of Nairobi. He says strong governance and rule of law are crucial for effective dispute resolution and preventing conflict and suffering.
We need to have the governance structures operating so that the judiciary and other arbitration or other dispute resolution mechanisms can operate. If we do not have a strong governance structure and institutions particularly working under the rule of law, it would be a waste of time to go to court or any forum to arbitrate or resolve your dispute, because the players will ignore it and continue destabilizing the regions. And this will continue to spur conflict and the suffering of the people.
Geopolitical tensions are also influencing some African countries' decision to deny or revoke licenses of some companies and give them to their newfound friends like China and Russia. Ocheng says the African countries' new built alliances are not threatening traditional mining firms, but regulatory measures are becoming challenging for them.
It's not necessarily the biggest threat for Western operators. For Western operators, it's just mostly an issue of compliance and ensuring that they have an understanding of how these governments, various governments, can have various factors of compliance that they need to adhere to. But the emergence of new players is definitely going to change that environment and is going to be seen either as an opportunity or a threat, depending on who is assessing it.
The ICSID says 88 proceedings were concluded in 2024. Of these, 71% were settled by the tribunal and 29% were settled or proceedings discontinued. This year, Tanzania reached an agreement with the Canadian company Montero Mining and Exploration Limited over a licensing dispute and agreed to pay $27 million. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
In the Gambia, a prominent economist says the just-concluded Senegal-Gambian Investment Forum is a step in the right direction to boost closer bilateral and economic ties between the two neighboring countries. Njie Nyang also says the economic integration of Dakar and Banjul needs genuine reciprocity based on what he says is a sustainable and mutually beneficial relationship. His remarks follow the just-concluded Gambia-Senegal Economic Forum. Gambian Vice President Mohamed Diallo and Senegalese Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko opened the forum in the Gambian capital, Banjul. For more about the forum and anticipated impact on the economic relations between the Gambia and Senegal, I reached Njie Nyang.
The relationship between the Gambia and Senegal is very unique, and this brotherly-sisterly relationship oftentimes poses some problems for both countries, but more so Gambia being the smaller country. And if you look at our net trade, Gambia imports quite a lot of things from Senegal relative to Senegalese buying stuff from the Gambia. And also in terms of labor, if you look at our labor force, masoners, drivers, welders, most of them are Senegalese. So the Gambian economy to a large extent relies on Senegalese goods and services, and this creates a lot of bureaucratic hurdles in terms of goods coming into the Gambia or goods trying to leave Gambia, even though it is within the ECOWAS sub-region. But the bureaucratic hurdles make it difficult and sometimes make it non-competitive for Gambian products to be sold in Senegal.
Will this forum resolve some of the challenges associated with the dynamic economic relations between Banjul and Dakar?
Well, generally, economies are fond of saying that in life, no one gets what they deserve, but what they negotiate. And historically, the only bargaining chip that Gambia used to have is the river crossing that connects northern Senegal to the southern part of Senegal, which is now breached. And also, it was a joint funding by the African Development Bank, which the both countries, you know, came up with a project. Yes, the bridge is in the Gambia, but it is now considered owned by the Gambia, but gives Senegal free access to cross the river at all times to get to southern Senegal, Casamas. So on the negotiating table, Jame used to use that as a bargaining tool, and right now we don't have that. So the big brother relationship, considering our internet comes from Senegal, most of our cooking gas and a lot of stuff that we use in our daily lives do come from Senegal. But we do hope that the Senegalese are sincere, and happening to have a new president who has a Pan-Africanist view is not trying to come up with an economic nationalism project, but a project of sustainable development for both countries. And Mr. Sonko made it very clear that Senegal's development is also contingent on Gambia's development. So we have to both benefit out of any arrangement that comes out of this forum.
Some are suggesting that Prime Minister Sonko's arrival signals the political commitment from the sister country in Senegal to engage the Gambia to resolve any pressing issues to ensure a smooth economic benefits from both countries. Your take as an economist?
Well, the last president that left, President Macky Sall, had a very warm and cordial relationship with President Barrow. So the relationship between the two capitals are good, but in terms of each country protecting its economic interests, I think Senegal has done a better job than the Gambia, and it has translated to much inflow of Senegalese goods and service, considering most of the infrastructural work that has been done in the Gambia, like road construction, most of them are Senegalese companies, and they have benefited largely. So if you look at the net trade, what Gambia benefits from Senegal economically is not much relative to Senegal. But what will change the dynamics is for the Gambia to reposition itself, because River Gambia is about to provide a big dam for Senegal, which will help their agriculture and energy production. Now, what Gambia gets in return for damming parts of the River Gambia upstream, that's what we have to negotiate as a nation. And our interest will not be guaranteed by anyone, but our able and competent capacity to make sure that Gambia's interest is protected and comes first.
Njie Nyang is an economist in the Gambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. In Cameroon, a leading member of the Opposition People's Action Party, or PAP, has endorsed longtime President Paul Biya's re-election bid ahead of next year's general election. Ngo Albert Mukwele, who heads a faction of the PAP, dismissed criticisms that his endorsement was state-managed to boost Biya's electoral prospects. The endorsement is generating debate with another faction of the party, which alleges Mukwele appears to have taken money from the government to endorse the president. He denies the accusation as without merit. Ngo Albert Mukwele tells me that PAP supports President Paul Biya's vision for 2035, which he adds is an ambitious plan for a prosperous country.
Okay, our endorsement actually falls in line with President Paul Biya's vision, 2035, to have Cameroon as an emerging nation. And what actually interests us the most is project like the Made in Cameroon program to promote products that are produced in Cameroon, the import substitution project, and other economic programs. We believe he's in the best position to actually drive. And as a people or as a group, we have actually worked with other political leaders before. Like some few days ago, I was actually an opposition leader. However, we have come to a point that we have realized that the best way we could actually be part of the development process or the emancipation of growth, peace, and development in Cameroon is to support the incumbent president.
But Albert, some of your critics are saying that you did not consult widely with members of your party before taking this decision, and that this decision basically undermines the very essence of the formation or the establishment of this political party.
That is not true. As a matter of fact, some time ago in 2016, we had some serious issues within the party when a group of people decided to change the status of the party. And since then, this particular group have just been causing havoc. They are, one day they'll be trying to divide Cameroon. The next day they are taking appointments from the same government. And so we who were like part of the founding members, or we came from the background of founding members, we decided that no, this is not the fabric of this political party. it actually undermines everything the political party stands for. The political party stands against division.
What do you say to your critics who say that you just endorse Paul Biya because you and a few others in your party want to get jobs from the president and get some largesse, for which reason you hurriedly went to endorse him without consulting anybody?
Okay, trust me, we did not hurriedly endorse President Paul Biya to seek for another term. This has been calculated, this has been studied, and before we took this decision, we got to a point that we realized that the best way out was for us to partner in the developmental process, in the peace process. Because the last thing that we wanted to identify ourselves with is to be part of this group that is causing disorder.
Are you saying that you are not being tele-guided by the regime, as some of your critics are saying?
I am not guided by the regime. I'm actually the son of the founding chairman of the party, Professor Victor Mukelengo. I am very meticulous. I'm somebody who does his homework. I study. That is why I spoke about the import substitution drive. I also spoke about the Made in Cameroon programs, which are some of the factors that are driving us.
Ngo Albert Mukwele is a leading member of the Opposition People's Action Party, or PAP. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. A Zimbabwe national park is hosting wildlife relocated from a game park just outside the country's capital after an autopsy report confirmed that four rhinos and several other wild animals died after drinking contaminated water from a lake in the game park. For VOA, Columbus Mavunga files this report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Tinashe Farao, spokesman for the Zimbabwe Parks and Wildlife Management Authority, confirmed to VOA the death of four rhinos after drinking bacteria-polluted water here at Lake Chivero, about 20 kilometers west of Harare.
We have done the tests with the University of Zimbabwe, and this case has been confirmed. We are not only losing the rhinos, but also we have also lost some zebras, wild beasts, and some birds. We have tried to treat some of the rhinos, but unfortunately, it seems like we are not managing at the moment. But we have made some temporary corrective measures to make sure that we deal with this challenge. We need to continue to make sure that at least we deal with the issue of pollution around Lake Chivero.
The temporary collective measures refers to transfers of wildlife away from Lake Chivero while the issue of the polluted water is addressed. Amukela Sidange is the spokesperson for the Environmental Management Agency of Zimbabwe. She says that nationwide, about 415 megaliters of raw sewage are being discharged into the environment daily.
And if we are to further analyze that statistic, city of Harare on its own contributes about 219 megaliters of raw and partly treated sewer that is discharged into the environment on a daily basis. And that goes to show how huge the crisis is. We need the whole of government and societal approach. And definitely, if we adopt this, then we'll avert a situation whereby problems are solved in installments. And in most cases, they don't have a much impact.
Jacob Mofue, mayor of Harare, says he's counting on the central government to assist and provide funding to help his city provide proper sewer services for all residents, and especially those that live in informal settlements.
However, the informal settlements have increased. We have over 150,000 informal settlements, and these settlements do not have sewer reticulation systems. Therefore, their discharge is going straight into our water bodies. And the challenge we are having is that around the shores of Lake Chivero, there is informal settlements, and these are again increasing poaching activities and also polluting the lake. These have to be stopped.
While the bickering continues among high-ranking officials about who is polluting Harare water with cyanobacterium, Farema Gu, director of the Center for Natural Resource Governance, is worried about the residents of Zimbabwe's capital city.
There's also need to carry out scientific investigation into the water that is pumped into the people's homes by Harare City Council and see whether that water is still safe for drinking and inform the citizens of Harare accordingly.
On Tuesday, Mafume declared that Harare's water was still meeting the WHO standards and was safe for drinking, although the council provides bottled water during its meetings. And for years now, residents of Harare generally drink bottled water and water from bowls. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. I intend in the next few commentary to present to the African audience historical foundation events that still impact on the continent. And the top historical event is the convening in Imperial Berlin capital, a conference of European leaders, not all of them, to deal with the African continent. Just imagine, these European leaders decided with map on the table to partition the continent. They have very little idea of the history, demographic patterns, tribes, but still they did it. The reason is, at that time, European leaders see Africa as the dark continent of peasants, and therefore they feel they could proceed without even consulting Africans who have managed major empires in Africa like Mali and Ghana. And African intellectuals in decades past that have analyzed that conference referred to it as the Berlin Disgrace. They became the foundation of the colonization of the African continent by some European powers. Many Africans that have gone to study in the West, in North America, for example, many of them went to the university in Oxford, Pennsylvania, Lincoln College, a highly regarded intellectual center for black students. They were there during the beginning of the Second World War. At the completion of their study, they all moved to Europe, many to England. At the same time, on the arrival in England, there are some of our early leaders, Nkrumah, Azikiwe, all of them there. And they were joined by the Kampucheans from the Caribbean, Dr. Eric Williams and others. And they knew their roots were in Africa, and they discussed among themselves. And they urged the Africans they've met to organize with Pan-Africanism, because they saw that the colonial powers of Europeans that have colonized them, their lands have been occupied by Nazi Germany. But they noticed that these European leaders who were in exile in England fought very hard against Nazi Germany to free themselves from occupation. And in these fights, they recruited African troops, not just foot soldiers, but some of them are aviators, and they helped the Europeans to liberate their lands. So they said, why should we, mean the Africans, accept the colonial powers in our land if they could not accept occupation itself? They also were watching far length the struggle of Gandhi in India, the pearl of the British Empire, and they returned home. An example, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, or then the Gold Coast. And they went back and they began to agitate for the end of colonialism in Africa. And mark it, these freedom fighters, Nkrumah and his so-called Veranda Boys, We're only asking for what the Europeans were divided is demanding in Europe from Libya. Nkrumah and his friends in Ghana looked not only to Ghana or to Gold Coast, but the liberation of the continent, and the struggle bore fruits. Ghana in 1957 became the first black African colony to liberate itself from the English colonial power. And a year after, another African country, Guinea-Conakry, with a firebrand leader, was faced with a choice. President de Gaulle, while being in exile in England, came out of the war with pride that France's colony in Africa has stood with him and not with petite France or puppet of Germany. So he decided that he would show his gratefulness to the French-speaking African colony and ask for a referendum on federation. But Sekou Touré decided he does not want to live within the Federation of France and voted for complete independence. De Gaulle was so incensed that he did accept the verdict of the Guineans to vote, but asked his functionaries to strip Guinea of all semblance of modernity. But Sekou Touré saw his friend in Ghana, and at that time, many Pan-Africanists from the Caribbean were already in Ghana, and the success of all this became known the 1960s as the decade of decolonization. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. I'm not afraid to
good, good things you do to make me no. This distance is taking a hold on me for sure. Baby, come. Shaping out this kind of things where they make man see ya. And me, I understand to your dad don't like
and that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, even the lion who is the king of the jungle protect himself from flies. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
No, they look for us, we know they are. When they see the mula, we don't spray out. Thank God, said him, not pay out. Oh, go. Man, getting high till I fade out. Be the vibe, no pure on my way out. Bula balu, anytime we stay about. The men, them outside, we know they are. No, they look for us, we know they are. When they see the mula, we don't spray out. Thank God, said him, not pay out. Oh, go.